You're listening to The Review, first broadcast on the 19th of October 2013 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to The Review, your weekly preview and review of the arts here on Monocle 24, coming to you from Studio One at Midori House, with me, Emma Nelson and Andrew Muller.
Coming up on today's programme, we review the contents of this year's Frieze Fairs in London.
We'll also talk to the Japan Times film critic Mark Schilling about what makes a Tokyo Film Festival so special.
We have to have films from China and Korea. It doesn't matter about the politics. If we don't have films from those two countries, we're not really an Asian film festival.
And we'll be finding out what art exhibitions are a must-see in Montreal this winter.
One is Phenomena, which is it's very unique. I can't imagine it happening anywhere outside of Quebec. And it's this interesting fusion of sort of bizarre poetry and cabaret and a fixation with sort of Dada and surrealism.
And our guest music reviewer is a Brazilian star, Sergio Veloso, better known as Siba. So lots to look forward to this week on The Review here on Monocle 24.
Hello, and welcome to Studio One at Midori House. You're listening to The Review on Monocle 24 with me, Andrew Muller, and Emma Nelson. Hello, Emma.
Hello, Andrew. How was your cultural week?
It was. I saw two actual films.
Actual films?
That's actual...
As opposed to past films.
Well, no, but that's actual culture. I saw Captain Phillips, the much ballyhooed Paul Greengrass drama starring Tom Hanks about that captain who gets hijacked.
Is there a touch of Bourne about it?
Yes and no. He's somewhat constrained by the fact that it is a more or less true story. But
that's never stopped many people in the past.
Well, this is true. But the thing that annoyed me a little bit about it was I thought he skipped on some of the more interesting aspects of the true story, because it has since emerged, since Captain Phillips, the actual Captain Phillips, wrote his book and this film was made, that the crew of the Maersk Alabama are not, it's fair to say, united in the belief that their captain was the upstanding all-American hero portrayed on
Again,
screen.
That's never stopped a director.
Indeed,
in the past.
But I actually think incorporating that conflict, apparently the captain was warned repeatedly, don't sail through this pirate-infested waters, it's infested with pirates, and went ahead anyway. I think some of that conflict would have been actually interesting.
Worth seeing?
Yeah, I mean, it's very well directed. It is quite tense, even though you basically know how it turns out. And although a lot of the script is just weirdly wooden, I thought.
Tom Hanks?
He's good. He's always good.
Fine.
Yeah.
Okay. My week was Woody Allen. I saw Blue Jasmine.
Oof.
Cate Blanchett, excellent, amazing, in an incredibly nervous film. When you say it's like classic Woody Allen, actually it's better than Woody Allen, because the stuff that Woody Allen churns out now is so hit and miss that
I've had wisdom teeth extractions which were better than Woody Allen.
Well, this was fine. This is anaesthetised, Mr. Muller. It was incredibly stylish, an incredibly astute portrait of how New York dealt with the crash. There's one woman in it, Jasmine, the sort of Blanche Dubois for 2013, who finds herself on her beam end because her husband was the great Bernie Madoff kind of character who sort of missold everyone's millions. And it's a great study of how every area of society deals with a baddie and how you try and recover or not, as is the case in this film. It's quite an amazing film, worth watching.
Fair enough. I may never know. I just sort of see the phrase directed by Woody Allen and it might as well just say the cinema will burn down
and
halfway
through. And that is why you go to see
through.
Tom Hanks films and I go to see Woody Allen films.
Yeah, I would also like to mention very briefly the excellent upcoming documentary on Gene Clark, the founder member of The Birds, called The Bird Who Flew Alone, which I did also see this week and which is an extremely serviceable documentary of a much underrated musical figure.
You're listening to The Review.
Now, Monocle 24 decamped for a couple of days last week to set up shop at Frieze, the event that sets the art world's autumn calendar in motion. Frieze is now huge, with two separate shows a 15-minute walk apart across London's Regent's Park.
With the addition of Frieze Masters last autumn, no chapter in arts history is unrepresented, although Frieze London, the show dedicated to works from post-2000, is still considered the showstopper. It certainly had the longest queues when I went. Ben Luke is the art critic for London's Evening Standard, and he joins us now. Welcome to the programme, Ben. It's good to have you in the studio. Let's talk about the size of Frieze. Now, I was knocked sideways, and it is apparently a smaller show than before, but it's huge.
It's huge. It's actually a bigger tent that it's in, but there are fewer galleries. So we're still talking about an absolutely enormous fair. It's 150 galleries. So, if you can imagine that the space has expanded and it's just been made a bit more user-friendly. It's much less packed, much less frenetic. There are big, wide aisles this time. And it just makes the whole experience just much
more... The operation was astonishing. I mean, the fact that they've had to place these two enormous tents... I mean, calling them tents doesn't even begin to describe the scale of them. Sort of the most artful hangars you could ever imagine. And they're beautiful. And you're sort of wandering around thinking, I can't believe I'm actually in a park. But then the whole slickness of the operation that goes around it. And it just seemed to be a sort of an otherworldly experience when I went around it.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's it. The art fairs are otherworldly. They are, I mean, art fairs are not the best places to see art. Let's face it. They are trade fairs, but they are very elegant form of trade fairs. So I always think the way that you've got to think with an art fair is don't treat it like going to a gallery or a museum. Separate it. Treat it as a place where you're going to see interesting things, but the overall experience is going to be a possibly unpleasant one.
It's all keyed into buying and selling, effectively. Talking to someone yesterday, and someone who works at Art Basel, he said that he'd walked into Frieze Masters. We'll come to Frieze London in a moment, but Frieze Masters, the show dedicated, the fair dedicated to everything up to the year 2000. He said he wanted school children to be allowed to go round this fair because it made him fall in love with art all over again. Because you see art in all its diversity, you see the absolute masters, and they're some of their finest examples that are obviously doing the circuit on the private market. But it completely refreshes you because of the way that it's laid out alphabetically. You get every period next to each other and you fall in love with everything. Is refreshing when you move around the fair.
I think that's it. The thing about Frieze Masters is you really do have the ancient world right next to basically contemporary, as you say, up to 2000. So there are really great moments. My favourite was on Kawara, the Japanese conceptual painter, one of his date paintings, which is simply a date written in white on black, right next to, you know, sort of over the aisle from a constable oil sketch, and you get all sorts of conjunctions like that. There's actually, some of them are deliberate. There was a wonderful collaboration between two galleries, one of whom shows Native American art and another which shows more modern art. And so you had Jackson Pollock next to Native American sculpture, and that was wonderful.
It worked a dream.
It was a really beautiful combination. It was really well thought out. And sometimes you felt that with Masters, people were trying to force that a little. You'd have an essentially historical stand, which would suddenly have a cluster of more modern works on it. And you'd think, oh, God, that's a bit forced. But where it wasn't forced, where it was really well done, it really does, as you say, it's enlivening. And for an art fair to do that is really quite a coup, I think. I mean, with Frieze Masters, when it arrived last year, you could almost audibly hear the gasps as people walked in because they really hadn't been to an art fair like this before.
I gasped. I mean, the way when you walk into Frieze Masters, there is an absolutely beautiful series of sort of early Renaissance and medieval Italian art when you walk in. And I thought, my goodness, this is like walking into a world-class gallery. And I switched off the money side and I went round and I just enjoyed it for what it was. Nonetheless, the money side is very, very prevalent. I mean, there are the most interesting-looking characters. I mean, I would almost argue that...
Interesting in this case sounds to me very much like a euphemism.
Well, what was it you said before we came on air, Ben and I had a quick chat, and you said that you mentioned something about amount of work done on the clients as well as on the canvases.
Yes. I mean, the scalpel is in evidence as much as the paint.
Is it that you find yourself wondering which is the Jeff Koons and which is the customer?
Right, precisely. I mean, you really do feel, especially on the preview days, you really feel that you are in the moneyed elite, moneyed global elite. You know, it should be said that, you know, this is the moment in London's art calendar when people come literally from all over the world. The top collectors from everywhere come to London to look at art. And that's why it's become this festival. That's why all the museums and galleries have really joined in, because they realised the first year that Frieze ever happened, that suddenly they had more people of influence in London at the same time than they'd ever had before. And so, you know, Frieze now dictates the art calendar. All the galleries save their best artists. They produce their best shows for the Frieze window. So it's an extraordinary shift in London's art capital.
Not just London's art world, it's shifted the global calendar now. Everybody now starts to exhibit in the next couple of months because Frieze kicks it all off. It's been strange, though. The commentary around Frieze this year has been more divided than I've noticed in previous years. For the last however long Frieze has been running, it's been universally applauded and welcomed. But this year, one noticed that the critics were sniping a little bit more about the fact that it is such a moneyed event. And of course, you know, you would be an idiot to assume it would be anything but.
As opposed to all those art fairs that had sort of aimed at,
exactly,
at the completely broke.
So why, Ben, do you think this is happening? Why are people now turning on Frieze? Is it a British thing, or is it something to do with Frieze itself?
I think the artist Michael Elmgreen has a really interesting theory about this. He's a maverick. He and Inga Dragset are a maverick duo from Scandinavia. They produce very biting satires on the art world and slightly melancholy, pathetic things as well. But they're great observers of the art world. And Michael says that the people that moan about art fairs and moan about biennials and these big events happening in the art world all over the place are the people that don't go to Peckham and Bethnal Green and Fitzrovia and see the galleries and see art all over the place. You don't have to do the art fairs if you don't want to. If you're a critic, you can pretty much ignore them if you really want to. But also, I would say, look, it's an art fair. It's happening. Let's find what's interesting in it. Let's go out there and look at this stuff. And, you know, actually, there's plenty that's rewarding if you really want to look for it.
What did you find?
Yeah, on that subject, for somebody such as myself who hasn't been to Frieze yet and has, I think, a day and a half left to do it, and if they're going to, what would you recommend starting with? What were the real high points for you?
Well, I think, first of all, you've got to see the Jeff Koons show on the Gagosian stand, because it's the thing that everybody's talking about. It's the thing that's really got everybody moving. Jeff Koons is probably the most divisive figure in the art world. He's regarded as an absolute god by many in the art world. He's regarded as the epitome of bling and the moneyed art elite by others. So he's got a stand. The Gagosian has a stand, and it features four sculptures and a single painting, all of which are worth multi-million pounds. So
you are absolutely aware of that due to the presence of the high level of security when you're going past it. And I just, you thought, hang on a minute, does the security guard come with the big wrapped heart that's,
yes,
worth goodness knows how many millions and what have you? You just think this is a very, very cleverly crafted thing that you actually create an installation out of creating the installation.
Well, precisely. I mean, it really does look like a satire. If you look at it, it's so big, burly security guards standing by major artworks, which actually are, for instance, an inflatable lobster, but made from aluminium, a wrapped up candy heart, you know, a kitten in a clothesline bag hanging off a clothesline with flowers.
Yeah,
enormous, ultimate ultra kitsch, but made, you know, the whole thing about Koons's work is made incredibly beautifully and handcrafted beautifully, and it's beautifully installed. You know, it looks extraordinarily professional. It looks like an exhibition rather than an art fair booth. So
I would be fascinated by a transcript of the internal monologue of the security guard. I'm just looking at the photo of the guy standing next to the lobster, who is actually far more, his expression is more of a work of art than anything in the Koons exhibit. It is that sort of, what the hell am I doing with my life thing he has going on there.
Well, I think this is
counting about the meter being running. It is amazing, though. It is tremendously good fun. Now you saw fun in Frieze London. I didn't. I was quite disappointed by how personal my reaction was to the fair. I was hoping that I could have a cool head when I went round it, and I couldn't. I found myself thinking, I'm not surprised or challenged or astonished. There's no gut stop. There was no stop. Gasp out loud moment for me in the fair at all. It kind of washed over me, and I was really disappointed by that. I thought there was something wrong with me. There is something wrong with me, isn't there, Ben? It is really good. Tell me that.
Well, I found plenty to get excited about. I actually love, my favourite section of Frieze London, the contemporary fair, is the frame section, which is actually where you have emerging galleries from all over the world showing single artists. So because they're booths dedicated to one artist, they have a coherence and a kind of consistency that you might not get on the more checkered booths that are presented by other galleries where they have one work by loads of their artists, and it's all a bit hodgepodge. In the frame section, you really do get a sense of emerging art from around the world. And I love that section. There was a section, there's a work by a very, very interesting London artist, a guy called Prem Sahib, and he's created this white cube, which is to the dimensions of his sort of teenage bedroom. And from within it, you hear this sort of pumping house music. Outside of it, you've got the kind of ropes that you might find outside a nightclub. And then on the wall, you have this, what looks like a sweaty mirror, but it's actually immaculately produced, through each bead of sweat produced in resin on this aluminium panel. So it's sort of like an abstract work of abstraction or minimalism, but given this sort of sense of the body in front of it. And I love that stand. It was a really thoughtful stand. It was about teenage idealism, about the desire of a teenager in his bedroom to go out into the wide world and to experience exciting things, you know. And so little things like that. And then there's another, which was enormous, what looked like a rock made from black aluminium foil, which was hung by a sort of rope, and you would walk directly beneath it, and it looked like it was going to crush you. And next to it was this drawing with a rope drawn in pencil very, very beautifully. And it was just this one tiny thread which was keeping that rope together. And you connected the two, and there was this lovely sense of drawing and sculpture working together and really involving the audience. So in frame, that's what I would advise people to do. Go to frame, see emerging art, and you do get a sense of things that you actually couldn't see anywhere else in the world.
And you have today and tomorrow to do that. Frieze Festival in Regent's Park in London. Ben Luke, London Evening Standard's art critic, thank you as ever for joining us. Still to come, we'll be taking a look at Montreal's winter art festivals.
Culture on Monocle 24 is untouchable. Go on, just try and do it. Try and grab a handful of the top-grade cultural radio that we're dishing out and see if you can touch it. Well, exactly. Luckily, though, you can feel it. Feel the passion of the unusually button-bright presentation.
It's a fantastic contrast, and it's one of those ones that ask you to look at the brushwork, to look just at the canvas.
Feel the craftsmanship in the breathtaking live Midori House sessions.
You know, I consider myself an entertainer, so I'm really about communication. I'm not really about expressing myself so much as trying to communicate with people and bring them to tears or bring them to laughter or what have you.
Feel the lovingly hand-stitched production, and most of all, feel the love of art.
It's there and it's true, but it's really only a small part of his work.
Feel the love of fiction, feel the love of film, feel the love of music, feel the love generally.
It is the most extraordinary collation of works that you would never normally see together.
Why not invite me round? Culture with Robert Bound is a well-behaved house guest and a joy to entertain.
That's Culture with Robert Bound, premiering every Monday at 1900 hours UK time, right here on Monocle 24.
When is a shop more than just a shop? Monocle visits three bricks and mortar businesses offering unique products and impeccable service in Toronto, Paris, and in Madrid.
The fascinating thing about spices is spices actually are a bit of the history of the opening up of the world, because different spices will tell you a little bit about where people went and what they brought back, and it's fascinating when you actually follow any spice.
Trader's Secrets Revealed in our Monocle briefing film, Spotlighting Retail, in the film's menu on monocle.com.
You're back with the review. Montreal's notoriously brutal winter isn't far away, but the city hasn't shut down just quite yet. Emily Rain is a co-founder of an arts and culture editor of Cult Montreal, the city's leading English language guide to its renowned underground culture. She sat down with Monocle's Montreal correspondent Patrick Pickman to talk about a few things going on in the city right now.
There's a lot always in Montreal. One new art exhibit, it's actually a fairly large one that's on for the next few months at the Musée d'Art Contemporain de Montréal. And it's from Vancouver. It's called Beat Nation. And it's sort of investigating the ties between street culture and hip-hop and Aboriginal communities, and brought together some of the best-known and most interesting contemporary young Aboriginal artists from all over Canada and the United States. Numerous nations are represented. And there's a lot of sort of remixed video installations. And throughout the whole thing, there's sort of this powwow beat. They got one of the guys from a tribe called Red participated. They do sort of, they call it powwow step, really a fusion of sort of Indian tribal beats and hip hop. And it's a great exhibit. It's sort of really, really interesting intersections between hip-hop culture and sort of subscribes to that backpacker ethos of hip-hop's bigger than just entertainment. We have to use it to be political. And so a lot of the projects that are involved in this exhibit are actually, I mean, quite overtly political, but also about trying to get reserve kids interested in Aboriginal history and to, you know, go back and learn the languages, and are the products of sort of community-oriented art projects. And just absolutely striking collection of art that's, that feels really contemporary and really important right now in Canada.
Does the contemporary art audience in Montreal generally respond to Aboriginal art? Is there a place for it? Is this quite a new thing?
You see the odd thing, but it's often quite historical, you know, whereas this is very contemporary and sort of accepting that, you know, Native culture has changed over the last 250 years and it's not just bone sculptures and, you know, and they take this sort of line form aesthetic and things like that in their work. But it was interesting. I was talking to one of the curators in Montreal, or Quebec's very interesting because it developed differently in relation to the native population as it was being colonized, in that the French traders are very quick to embrace native life and to sort of intermarry. And the Quebecois population is highly Métis. Like, there is a lot of native blood in pretty much everyone, but it's never talked about. So I felt like this exhibit was a perfect way to sort of bring that conversation in a way that makes it interesting for young people, too. And also, it's the kind of exhibit that, you know, I in earnest would send my friends to, which doesn't always happen in the sort of big publicly funded galleries. But to me, it was like any of my friends would enjoy it. It was it's just feels very contemporary and timely. And it is something that, you know, like most nations, Canada, we have to deal with that, that sort of dirty laundry in our heritage. So.
And so that one's on right now?
It's on right now. It opened on Wednesday and it's on through the beginning of January.
Montreal, this time of year, I've been looking at the weather forecast with something approaching terror. It's winter's coming, shall we say, but art's not really shutting down just yet, is it?
It's not, actually. There's a couple of interesting festivals starting up. One is Phenomena, which is it's very unique. I can't imagine it happening anywhere outside of Quebec. And it's this interesting fusion of sort of bizarre poetry and cabaret and a fixation with sort of Dada and surrealism, and they do kind of public interventions. They do numerous marionette, for adults, marionette and puppetry shows from all over the world, and especially France. And then kind of alternative, they're really interested in interdisciplinarity. So there's a lot of sort of dance inspired by Georges Méliès, the cinema pioneer. And sort of they do tableau vivant, just really unusual kind of art interventions, often very performative, that there isn't really a space for it. Always at the borders of different things that are happening. So that's really exciting. And then next month, we're just wrapping up the Festival du Nouveau Cinéma, which is sort of our big international art show blockbuster festival. And then the next film festival that starts the week after that one closes is RIDM, which is our documentary festival. So that's exciting.
Montreal's always got some sort of festival on the go.
It's a festival town. Yeah, especially in the summer. It's almost exhausting. I mean, basically, our publication, we were monthly throughout the year. And then the summer, we literally had to double our output just because sometimes there'd be five or six really interesting festivals happening all at the same time. I mean, it's crazy. The number of options you can have on any given night in a July evening in Montreal, there'll be 30 things that you legitimately kind of want to do. But, you know, that's not possible. We always like to say that basically, or I always like to say that the winter lets us recover from the summer because it's just a nonstop, very boozy, stay out all night culture. And we have so much light. And so everyone sort of stays out in the streets and parties until midnight. And then in the winter, we all read novels and hibernate. And nobody leaves their house between sort of November and February, kind of.
And what else is coming up?
There's a lot of interesting stuff around sort of smaller things. At the Phi Center, it's a very interesting space. It's in Montreal's old port, which is the section of the city that was first developed. So it's sort of like, I call it a cheap Europe, sort of that 17th century aesthetic. So there's this huge gallery down there that's this multi-purpose space. They have a venue in there. They have screening rooms. They have office space. They have several different galleries and a boutique as well. It's called the Phi Center. And what they've recently started doing is inviting Montrealers who have sort of pronounced international presence to take over the center and sort of avail themselves of its resources to present whatever kind of curated events they want. And this is the third one right now, Rod Hourani, who's sort of unisex, very conceptual designer from Montreal, who mainly lives in Paris now, is taken over. And so he's putting on a few different concerts. He's having Pierre Lapointe play, and as well as setting up a very well-curated boutique of designer clothing in there. And then he's also lined up a bunch of screenings and an art show of his pictures. So that's really exciting. Each person that's sort of taken over this center has done really interesting things with it. I believe Gavin McGinnis from Vice is the next curator, but it's sort of interesting to see, you know, to take someone who's very, very creative and very successful and be like, here's a huge space and an infinite amount of staff and resources. You have a month, go. And to see what they can sort of pull out of their pocket or what they decide they want their dream to be, to have this space. The last one was actually Pop Montreal, which is the city's biggest kind of alternative or indie music festival. And it was interesting because they already have their festival. They already have the chance to have a venue. So what they did was use the space for a month and created a whole bunch of residencies and just sort of set a bunch of artists who weren't at the end actually responsible to produce anything or display anything. But just, here, you can use our resources. We have this great thing. You have a month, make stuff, go nuts. And then we'll see in the spring when we do our next presentation of, you know, shows or art fairs or whatever. So.
Well, thanks a lot for joining us, and enjoy this last run of stuff before the ice sets in.
I can't wait to sleep all winter.
And that was Monocle's Montreal correspondent Patrick Pittman speaking to Emily Rain, the culture editor of Cult Montreal.
Still to come, a music review with Brazil's Siba. So we are joined by one of the most exciting talents in Brazil's music scene. His album was described one of the best things that Brazil has produced this year. I'm glad to say that joined in the studio is Siba.
Siba.
Welcome.
You'll get your turn shortly. Siba, known at home as Sergio Veloso, was a founder member in the early 90s of the influential Brazilian group Mestre Ambrosio. His solo works to date have been a blend of the street music and Brazilian pop he grew up with, the British and American rock that reached him later in life, and more recently, the rhythms of Congolese and Senegalese music. And Siba, though he's already revealed himself, does join us in the studio now. Siba, you can talk now. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
I wanted to ask, first of all, about that the influence on your later work, the Congolese and Senegalese music. How did you happen across that?
Well, it comes from my interest in guitar first, because at 14, 15, I was a rock guy, just equal the same everywhere, everybody. And then you get interested in blues, and then you know that it comes from Africa. And I was trying to open my mind in music. So it really happened really before in my 20s. So the Congolese music is more recent. Recently that I discovered this music, and then it's really blowed me away. And it's a very strong now relation that I have with this kind of music.
What was it like growing up a rock guy in Brazil?
This is the regular, it's normal, because this music is playing all around, and I wasn't in the 80s, so I was listening to this and not looking to the music of my own place. So then I tried to look at the opposite way, and one of the ways to do this was to try to look at the music of Africa at the same time, because we have a lot of Africa there, in the city, in the traditional music, in the street music there. A lot of Africa there too.
When you grew, and I grew up myself a bit away from, I guess, the hubs of rock music. I grew up in Australia, and you grow up with that kind of sense maybe that the local product isn't really quite as good. There's a sort of an inferiority attached to that. Did you find the same with Brazil? Did you have to, did it get a bit, did the local music when you were growing up get a bit drowned out by American rock and roll?
Yes, for sure. But I'm talking about something that happened mostly in the 80s.
Okay.
In Northeast Brazil. And then in the 90s, my generation did the opposite in the city and then in the country. We begin to talk about looking at our own music and trying to do our own music, even if it's based on rock and other music from outside. But we did it before, so now Brazil doesn't have this problem. It's not only this way, you know.
I mean, how much do you think that the way that, you know, I say Brazil doesn't have that problem anymore, how much do you think that your group, Mestre Ambrosio, actually helped there?
I think we were part of a bigger thing that happened in the 90s. It began in Recife, our city, because it's a very, very special city, because it's a city that has got a very rich musical tradition, street music tradition. And at that time in Brazil, we have a very separated Brazilian styles of music in playing in radio, like samba and Brazilian rock, and very few different styles. And then in Recife, it began a musical movement that each band had a different music, and people couldn't put us in a style, strictly style. And then I think now it's in Brazil, so everywhere is like this. You can't like put us things in very strictly about Brazilian music.
Okay, well, let's have a listen to some of your Brazilian music. This is the title track, I believe, from your new album, Avante.
Um assovio solta um pássaro que rasga o espaço e voa, que parte, mas não retorna, é que ilumina quando entoa. Deixa sombra na lembrança, mas já morreu quando ecoa.
It was Avante, the title track of the new album by this week's guest music reviewer, Siba. You can tell from listening to that that you grew up as a rock guitarist.
Even though it
sounds very South American pop, you can't help yourself. There's that big angry guitar in the middle of it.
There's also a tuba in there.
Yes, our bass is a tuba.
Why do you choose that?
The tuba is a very important instrument for us in the street music. And my last group, it was a group with only horns and percussion. So I built this relation with the tuba, working with it a few years. So I can't help myself to have a tuba now.
Now, for those of us whose Portuguese is not quite as good as it could be, tell us about how you go about choosing your lyrics and what themes you would draw upon.
I come from a very strong tradition in poetry. From the Northeast, which is oral poetry that is made to be sung, to not to be written, and it's you will find it in very different musical shapes, and I really worked hard on this, and so this is the main base of my music. In fact, is the music to be like the transport for the poetry, and it's very this poetry. I got many different laws, mathematics to be done. It's the main part of my art, I think. But you can talk about everything you want, from personal issues to nature, to politics, to history, everything. I can't tell what is about everything, because I can talk about anything.
You were speaking earlier about the vast international array of musical influences that you've had. Are your lyrical influences worldwide as well, or is it an exclusively Brazilian lyrical tradition you're working in?
I can say it's exclusive, because I like to read also, and since I can speak a little English and read a little in English too, so I can't say this is not part of what I do, you know, but it's not that easy to track it in a very straight way. It's there because I travel, I read, but I cannot tell you where is it to help.
Okay, well, we're going to play a track which isn't by you now. This is another one of the tracks you've chosen. This is Lira with Eli Vidança. Before we play it, introduce Lira to us.
Lira is one of the main singers and composers in Brazil, in my opinion now. He comes from my city. He just released the CD last year, and I love his work. And he also is connected with this kind of poetry I was talking about. So that's it.
Okay, well, let's hear a bit of it. This is Lira.
Vai cantar todas as músicas, vai pra desfazer a dor da quarta-feira.
Uh-huh.
was Lyra with Ela Vai Dançar, one the second choice of this week's guest music reviewer, the Brazilian singer Siba. That again, it sounds very South American, but has that great big rock guitar over the top of it. And of course, South America, Brazil in particular, does have a great rock and roll and heavy metal tradition as well.
Well, I think so. I don't know. There's a lot of time that I'm not that rock guy again, you know. So if you ask me to talk about rock in Brazil now, I will be not the best person.
Who are your audiences?
Because I have these influences, and but I'm not into this anymore. But for sure, you can listen to this track. There's a lot of guitar and rock influence on this.
Who is listening to your music and listening to Lyra now? I mean, how have your audiences changed as you've obviously grown older and matured? Have your audiences grown up with you?
Yeah, but we are not like playing the radio in Brazil. The radios in Brazil are really closed for us. So we feel like in a alternative stream of music in Brazil. We're not the main thing happening. But since we have internet and all this to help, we can... We have a big audience for us that follow us. And we play all around the country. It's not a bad situation, I can tell you.
Your final selection for us this evening is, this afternoon rather, or this evening if you're listening to it in the evening. It is one of your definitive rock guy tracks. It is Jimi Hendrix, who I think has been an influence on you and on that Lyra track most obviously. How and when did you first hear Hendrix, and what effect did it have on you?
Well, this is very important for me because I was already a guitar young guy in Recife. I was hearing to the 70s and 60s rock, but I had not listened to Hendrix for some reason, you know. And I remember the first time I got in touch with his music, and it changed me a lot. And I couldn't listen to anything anymore for 2 years. I went really deep on that.
What did your friends and family think of that?
Nobody understood a lot. But after hearing Hendrix, I could hear anything, so I began to hear jazz and try to listen to different music from different places of the world. So I don't think of Hendrix as a guitar and rock musician. It's much more than this. So it's a whole world and one person in music.
Here is a small sliver of that world. This is Jimi Hendrix with Crosstown Traffic.
I'm not the only soul accused of hit and run, tire tracks all across your back. I can see you had your fun, but darling, can't you see my signals turn from green to red? And with you, I can see a traffic jam straight up ahead. You're just right, so hard to get through to you.
Jimi Hendrix and Crosstown Traffic there, the choice of today's music reviewer, Siba. Siba, thank you very much indeed for joining us. What brings you to London? We've run out of time, but tell us what you're doing in London and for the next few days.
Tomorrow I'll be performing on the Barbican Centre with Milton Nascimento also there. And then we go to Paris to release the CD and do some radio broadcasting, this kind of thing.
So we wish you the very, very best of luck with that. Siba, thank you very much indeed for joining us on today's review.
Thanks a lot.
It's time now to cross to Istanbul to hear what's coming up over the coming days. Monocle's senior editor Sophie Grove is here to guide us through it.
Istanbul has just emerged from the week-long religious holiday of Bayram, and this weekend we'll see the city burst back into life as many of its residents return from the provinces. It's the final weekend of the 13th Art Biennale, and a last chance to explore the diverse exhibits on show at Istanbul Modern and other venues around the city. The running theme is, Mum, am I a barbarian? And more often than not, the artworks focus on the concept of public protest and political dissent. I'll be returning to the neoclassical Greek primary school in Karakoy to take a last glance at the hauntingly beautiful building, which was closed in 1988 due to the city's dwindling Greek population. It's been reclaimed by the Biennale as a temporary venue. An Elm Screen and Drag Set's thoughtful installation here is definitely worth another look. As is Anika Eriksson's video, I Am the Dog That Was Always Here. It explores Istanbul's gentrification from the point of view of dogs. And never mind the artworks, a rare glimpse at the beautiful interior is worth the tram fare alone. On a less polemical note, I also plan to drop into the Pera Museum on the Golden Horn to see an exhibition by the Greek sculptor Sophia Vari. Vari is the Barbara Hepworth of her time and works with geometry, volume and shapes using marble and precious metal. Istanbul is limbering up for its next jazz festival on the 25th of this month. But in the meantime, there's a seemingly endless lineup of jazzers to fill the city's dark, atmospheric dives. Saturday night, the Nardis Jazz Club will host a performance by a young Turkish singer, Zelen Beyetkin, a civil engineer turned soul artist who draws a loyal following. Elsewhere at Babylon, another club hidden away in the back streets of Beyoğlu, an act called Four in the Pocket will present their Turkish reinterpretation of Jill Scott-style funk and soul. Here, as in so much Turkish music, improvisation is the art form, and the performance should go on well into the evening over glasses of chilled Efes Pilsen. And on Sunday afternoon, after a long brunch, I plan to spend some hours at İnebilu, an Anatolian culinary institution in Beyoğlu's Kas Impasa district. This may not be high culture, but the baskets of hazelnuts, flower stalls, and herbs of every description make wonderful viewing and delicious eating too. For Monocle, in Istanbul, I'm Sophie Grove.
Sophie's baskets of hazelnuts there. What's not to be loved about that?
You are listening to The Review on Monocle 24. We will be back with a look at the film festivals happening this weekend in London.
24/7, 28 programmes, up to 10 hours of speech a day. There's a glorious feast of Monocle 24 to savour. But when you want a slimming digest, fear not, we've got The Curator. Premiering every Saturday and downloadable via monocle.com and at iTunes, it's a weekly roundup of the best from the week that was. Hours of audio output distilled into 1 hour of selected interviews, quirky dispatches and journalistic coups. Plus, here again, from the entrepreneurs, urbanists, architects, artists and culinary masterminds who made Monocle 24 special over the past 7 days. That's The Curator, here on Monocle 24, premiering every Saturday at 9 a.m. London time.
Welcome back. It's Saturday and you're listening to The Review with me, Andrew Muller and Emma Nelson. As London's film festival winds down, and more on that shortly, Tokyo's is just hitting its stride.
The 26th Tokyo Film Festival sees it becoming ever more confident, increasing the amount of homegrown product at the expense of Western imports. Monocle's Tokyo correspondent Fiona Wilson spoke to the Japan Times film critic Mark Schilling.
Well, it's always kind of chaotic the first day. You know, they have the parade down what they call the green carpet, which is recycled plastic or something. Then they appear before, you know, the fans on this big stage. Then they finally come into the theater. So most of them didn't make it into the theater. The ones I saw, well, Tom Hanks and Paul Greengrass, you know, of course they were there. And the Prime Minister of Japan, okay, spoke a few words. Some other bureaucrats stood up and said something. I mean, this is because the festival is sponsored to some extent by the government. You know, of course, many private sponsors, but yeah, they had to give their due to the people that pay the bills, right?
So did you stay for the opening film? Did you see Captain Phillips? What did you think?
Yes, I did. I was planning to cut out early because, you know, there's a party always, you know, about the same time as the screening. I stayed for the whole thing. It was a great thriller.
Now, what are the highlights of the festival this year? What are you excited to see?
Well, again, like the opening film with Tom Hanks standing up there. I mean, he came about 4 years ago for another film. But yeah, it's been a while since I've seen him on stage, and very funny, as usual. And Yeah, I mean, that's a thrill. I'm a groupie, I guess. But in terms of the films, I mean, you know, I cover the Japanese films mainly. So, you know, there are two in competition that look very promising by two young directors. You know, there are some big films, big commercial films, and what they call the special screening section. And also a special section for Japanese indie films called Japanese Cinema Splash. And there's some others scattered around. So there are plenty of Japanese films to see. That's not a problem. The problem is, you know, if you're talking about the directors of people in London or Paris or Rome might know, there aren't too many at the Tokyo Film Festival because, you know, people like Miike and Kurieda and Kitano and Miyazaki will send their films to Europe way before, you know, they're going to send them to a festival like Tokyo.
So this is the first year for, there's a new director this year of the festival, isn't there? Yasushi Shina. Do you think he's made any big changes?
There have been some changes because, you know, the director general changed. You know, it's a man named Yasushi Shina. He's been in the industry for a long time. But the core staff doesn't change too much from year to year. You know, the programmer, you know, the head programmer they have now has been doing that job since 2007. So, you know, there's a continuity now that didn't exist before. You know, before they recycle people in, cycle them out after a year or two. So, you know, you have different sections. You know, Japan Cinema Splash used to be called Japanese Eyes. But, you know, it's basically the same. I mean, they have the same programming philosophy and, you know, it carries over from year to year. What they're interested in, you know, I talked to the chief programmer, Yatabe-san. He said, what we're looking for mainly now is, you know, young Japanese and Asian directors, you know, with a mixture of, you know, senior veteran directors, you know, to keep people aware of what's going on. But also, you know, they have to think of the audience. It's a film for ordinary film fans. It's not, you know, they have an industry section, you know, they have a market. But, you know, mainly it's for the people of Tokyo and whoever else can buy a ticket.
I mean, I'm noticing going to the cinema here that there are fewer foreign films on offer. It seems that Japanese films are more dominant at cinemas now than they used to be. Are you noticing that trend?
Yeah, that's been true for several years now, you know, going back to about 2006 when, you know, after many, many years, the market share shifted from foreign films, mainly Hollywood films, to Japanese films. That's the way it's been. You know, you have a situation where Hollywood films, with a few exceptions, like Mission Impossible last year, the Harry Potter series, the big blockbuster franchises will do well here. But beyond that, yeah, it's very difficult for Hollywood films.
I mean, do you think that's part of the role of the film festival to introduce a more diverse range of foreign films to a Tokyo audience?
Actually, if you look at the lineup of the Tokyo Film Festival, you know, they're showing films, you know, that Captain Phillips, that's a huge commercial release, right? But also films that would probably never find release or be shown in Japan if it weren't for the Tokyo Film Festival. You know, they have an entire section called World Focus that brings in films that were shown at other festivals but don't have a Japanese distributor. So in that way, yeah, they're spreading the word.
So I was interested that the head of the jury is a Chinese director, Chen Kaiger. I was wondering, what do you make of that?
Well, I think it's a great thing. He's been to Tokyo for the festival before. And his films are well known here. He's well respected here. You know, in terms of politics, you know, Japan and China are not getting along that well now. But again, I talked to the head programmer, Mr. Yatabe, and he said, we have to have films from China and Korea. You know, it doesn't matter about the politics. If we don't have films from those two countries, we're not really an Asian film festival. I think in a way, it's their mission.
That was the Japan Times film critic Mark Schilling talking to Monocle's Tokyo correspondent Fiona Wilson. And you're listening to The Review here on Monocle 24. The 57th London Film Festival finishes this weekend. Our researcher Fernando Augusto Pacheco has been one of the many reviewers courting a popcorn overdose as he attempts to keep up with the press screenings. Here are his highlights.
Gravity, directed by Alfonso Cuarón, is truly a unique film. It could well be the first sci-fi film to win the Oscar for Best Movie. It truly captures the fear of being alone in the space. And Sandra Bullock, as the main character, was a good choice. bringing a much-needed charisma to the role.
Do you copy?
Yes, yes, yes, I copy. I'm detached. I don't know. I'm spinning. I can't.
Report your position.
GPS is down. I can't. It's down. I can't.
Give me a visual.
The visual effects are incredible, and it shows that filmmakers can do interesting things with 3D, unlike the many 3D flops of the last 2 years, when most filmmakers were trying to cash in with the novelty. From the space to a three-hour-long drama that won the Palme d'Or in this year's Cannes Festival. Blue is the Warmest Color is a fantastic film and very naturalistic, counting with superb performances by Léa Seydoux and Adèle Exarchopoulos.
Pourquoi t'allais dire à tout le monde qu'on était dans des barguets, bordel? En plus, tu l'assumes, tu dis bah ouais, on allait dans des barguets, pourquoi tu fais ça, putain?
Qu'est-ce que tu veux que je te dise? On allait dans des barguets, on dirait c'est la fin de.
Bah ouais, ouais, c'est la fin du monde, putain. Tout le monde croit que je suis lesbienne et que je broute des chattes et qu'elle croit que j'ai maté son cul.
En plus, t'avais pas dit, je vais lui demander calme.
The film is well known for its intense and lengthy scenes of lesbian sex. But instead of feeling exploitative, the scenes added to the love between the two characters. And the way it was shot, it was pure cinema heaven. A Marky Mark lookalike, played by Joseph Gordon-Levitt, who in fact directed and scripted the film, is the star of Don John, a sleek romantic comedy about a man who just can't get enough of his porn, which is causing some problems in his relationship with women.
Come on, swing. You caught me watching porn.
That's it?
Right?
Oh! How do you watch that?
How do you watch all the stupid movies that you watch?
Movies and porno are different, John. They give awards for movies.
They give awards for porn, too.
When he finally finds the right woman, she finds out about his addiction and everything's over. Until he finds Esther, played by Julianne Moore. And well, it's all a happy end, folks. Ending my London Film Festival experience is Steve McQueen's spectacular account of Solomon Northup's life, based on the book with the same title as the film, 12 Years a Slave.
Where are you from, Platt?
I told you.
Tell me again.
Washington.
Who were your master?
Master named Freeman.
Was he a learned man?
I suppose so.
He learned you to read?
A word, here or there. But I've no understanding of the written text.
Don't trouble yourself with it. Same as the rest, Master brought you here to work, that's all.
The acting is incredible, especially the look of despair of Chiwetel Ejiofor, who plays Solomon. I would say it's possibly one of the best films ever made on the subject of slavery. I look forward for next year's event already. For Monaco, I'm Fernando Augusto Pacheco.
What's there not to love with feeling that vibration with Marky Mark there? That was Fernando Augusto Pacheco. The time is 58 minutes past, so it's time to say goodbye to our weekly review show. Thank you for listening. Our show today was produced by Hannah Jenkins, Katie Bilbao and Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Our studio manager was Claire Urban.
Georgina Godwin returns to the studio now to continue our weekend programming with The Curator, Monocle's best of radio show, which presents some of the unmissable highlights from the week that was on Monocle 24.
Of course, if there's anything else you think you've missed here on Monocle 24, you can download it all from iTunes or go to our website monocle.com/radio. You've been listening though to The Review with me, Emma Nelson, and Andrew Muller. Goodbye, thanks for listening, have a great weekend.
From London
to New York
to Tokyo,
to Buenos Aires,
to Zurich,
to Hong Kong,
to Tel Aviv,
to Toronto,
to Amsterdam,
to Berlin,
all around the world, this is Monocle 24.
Rolex timepiece represents an ongoing commitment to innovation, horological expertise, and the passion of skilled watchmakers. All add up to make the one principle by which Rolex lives, that greatness is a journey that never ends. Rolex.